Okay, guys. I'm going to give you kind of an overall WOTUS viewpoint from someone who has worked with members on Capitol Hill throughout this entire rulemaking process. And for me, one of the most frustrating pieces of this is kind of getting EPA to kind of acknowledge to farmers what's regulated and what's not regulated and what's going to be in play. In fact, I think for the most part, they crafted a lot of their talking points to not only mislead farmers and ranchers that you were going to be okay if because there's ag exemptions in play, but I think also to mislead Congress because we went to Farm Bureau in general, not just the American Farm Bureau, but all the state Farm Bureaus spent a lot of time with members on the Hill, and they really couldn't get a straight story as to what this rule would mean for farmers and ranchers. And what I want to highlight for you is kind of three areas where we see farmers are going to have a real problem after they've determined there's a WOTUS. Now, the big one is just how broad the WOTUS jurisdiction is. And the only way they're going to find out what that is to go to the Corps and EPA to ask for that determination. And that is, believe me, scary after they start hearing stories like John Duarte's story. They don't want to know. And again, this is not the kind of thing that's going to hit a wall tomorrow. It's going to be a generational rule. It's going to be a rule that over 20 years, all of a sudden we're going to find ourselves in court and we're going to be arguing about these things, and it's just going to be like it's going to get tighter and tighter and tighter. And all of it is embedded in this regulation. So, for instance, once you determine you have a WOTUS, and it is exceedingly broad, and we can talk about that, but there's three things that farmers have to worry about. They have to worry about, number one, if they use a conveyance, things like sprayers and applicators and spreaders. Those are regulated because they're point sources, or at least that's what the courts are telling us, number one. Number two, we know that if farmers do have normal farming practices, that those sprayers and point sources aren't covered under that exemption. EPA never differentiated that in this process. Number two, plowing is exempt, but only a certain type of plowing. And that's what really has John in a bind here. John explicitly, when he plowed this field, set a depth gauge so he didn't plow too deep. EPA says you can only plow the upper surface, in whatever that means. And they don't give us specifics. Can you plow 8 inches deep? Can you plow 12 inches deep? Can you plow 24 inches deep but not 48 inches? That's number two, how deep you can plow and then or manipulate the land. And number three, what are you doing? Are you trying to change what you're doing to an ongoing operation? Now, nowhere in the statute does Congress say that if you've been grazing land, you can't plant wheat on it. Or if you've been grazing land, you can't plant corn on it. Or if you've been growing rice, you can't plant tomatoes. Nowhere in the ag exemption says that. But EPA and their regulations are going to interpret it that way. So three things, applicators that are point sources, plowing too deep, or manipulating the landscape, including things like building fence. And number three, if you try to change the use from what EPA considers an ongoing operation. Those are big things. Those get farmers into trouble, and nowhere in this debate did EPA acknowledge that. If you layer those three liabilities on top of an exceedingly broad jurisdiction, you have what John has, a huge problem. John, come up and explain your problem.
Sure. Thank you, Don. Well, that's truly a perfect setup because this sounds nice. We all love the critters, right? We don't think we ought to be farming in strakes and lakes and streams and ponds. That doesn't sound good, does it? Well, we're not. That's not what we're talking about. Is there a handout available? Okay. I really would like to, you know, picture's worth 1,000 words, and if I'm speaking, it's worth even more than that, if we can avoid some of that. So going to a timeline here. My family purchased a property up in Tehama County that had been grazing land, and some other parts of it than what we planted to wheat had been wheat land also, in 2012. And we went ahead and planted wheat on this property in the fall of 2012. At that time, I'll show you in a couple slides, but the wheat markets were fairly favorable. It got a call somewhere in December of 2012. You guys are operating in wetlands. You're deep ripping the soil. Well, we're planting wheat. We're not deep ripping. We were chiseling at the time. We were plowing at the time about 8 inches deep. In some areas, we might have gone 12. There's no contention by any of the experts on either side that there was any activity below 12 inches on this property. So it truly is just a wheat planting. And the wetlands that we're speaking about are what's known as vernal pools. These aren't streams and habitats. There's no frogs around them. I don't think they stay wet long enough for a polywog to become a frog. These are small depressions in rolling grassland that maybe have water in them 3 or 4 times a year when it rains and pools. Here's some handouts. I want to just give Don a second to get these handouts because it's a very visual story, and it just doesn't come across as ridiculous without the visuals. But if you go to, you see page 1 is just the title page, 2 is the timeline, and 3 is the really important one that gives you an idea of what we're talking about here. This is what we're talking about. This is a wetland under. Is it there? There it is. Yeah. Page 3. That's a vernal pool. That's the wetland we're speaking of right now. You can see it's a big green field, and it's got a little white hole in the middle of it. That's a vernal pool. The reason that's white is because it's got adapted plant species that are specific to that vernal pool ground. It's got hydric soils, meaning the water doesn't drain from them well. It's got vernal pool topography, meaning the water pockets there. You know, no one wants to grade and fill these because they are wetlands. You've got to preserve them. And it's got evidence of those two conditions are the wetland vegetation. It's got this special vegetation. The wheat doesn't want to grow there. And the vernal pool plant species do grow there. And it's evidence that there is a vernal pool there, and it's evidence that there was a vernal pool there today. And no wetland has been destroyed, no wetland has been filled. In ripping, when there's a concern about ripping in these types of soils, it's deep ripping. If you want to put orchards or vineyards in, sometimes you want a deep rip. You want a slip plow, you want to get a shank through the ground, maybe 5 or 6 feet deep, that will destroy the impermeable layer below these vernal pools and in other parts of the field where water doesn't percolate well and allow the roots of the perennial crop, the tree crop, to get down into the soils much deeper. That's illegal. If you rip out the subsoil that perches the water in this vernal pool, you will destroy the vernal pool as a unique ecosystem. If you simply farm over the top of it, you plow deep enough to put a little wheat through there, you do not destroy it. This land has been planted before. In the late 70s and early 80s, it was chiseled from what we can tell from many, many, many thousands of dollars in expert surveys. Most folks wouldn't look at it this closely. We can tell for a fact this land has been chisel plowed down to 18 to 24 inches regularly when it was planted to wheat in the past. So our wheat farming probably wasn't as good as past wheat farming efforts. So in the Clean Water Act, it says very clearly, plowing will never cause a discharge. The act of plowing is completely excluded from the jurisdictions of the Clean Water Act in the very first set of standards written. And then in 1977, the Congress went back and clarified the Clean Water Act to add to the Army Corps of Engineers statute that plowing cannot cause a discharge, and said again, in legislation, plowing will never constitute a discharge. It is not a point source, and therefore what it discharges is not a pollutant under the Clean Water Act. It's very, very clear. And what did Congress do otherwise? Last year and this year again, there's been a budget reconciliation rider that went through that said the agencies can't even spend money to regulate a permitting process for farmers plowing their fields under the Clean Water Act. Went through Congressman LaMalfa, who's actually the congressman in this district, is the one who put it through because the Duartys aren't that special. It's happening to a lot of his constituents up in that area. So what did the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers and Department of Justice do? They found another otherwise. They said, well, it's not plowing of Bustignon, it's destruction of wetlands. And this is how we're going here. And then the agencies added also another regulation that was never in the Clean Water Act under the ag exemption is very broad. The plowing exclusion is very broad and very clear. The Army Corps of Engineers has said, if part of an ongoing farming operation. Well, if you look at the red circle on, which page are we on? There's a line chart of wheat prices. A couple pages in, you see a big red circle around 1979 to 82 when this land was previously farmed to wheat. Looks like there was a bit of an uptick in wheat prices. I can't tell if that was an attractive wheat price back then or not. I wasn't a wheat farmer. But then you look from then until current times, about 2008, wheat prices were in the tank. There's no reason to require farmers to plant wheat on ground at sub-economic conditions to oversupply a glut of wheat. It makes no sense. But by the Army Corps' continued ongoing farm practices requirement, if you don't plant wheat when it's not profitable, you lose your right to farm your land. I don't think the Food Security Acts or the Clean Water Act or any other act of legislation on the part of the U.S. ever intended to force farmers to plant uneconomic crops in order to retain their right to farm. But that's what we're doing now. And then they want to say if there's zero impacts on wetlands. Well, if you farm any environment in any ecosystem, your farming operation is going to have an impact. We use resources to produce food. There's no question to that, and I don't believe we need to be apologetic about it. Farming itself is a natural resource, and I think when we put irrigated farmland into production, we enhance the resources. So what's really going on? There's a page, next page in there, a couple pages down, you'll see a map of Tehama County and some surrounding counties that is a map of vernal pool recovery areas around Northern California. Now, this was an effort on the part of the Fish and Wildlife Service to establish habitat recovery plans under the ESA for several species of vernal pool fairy shrimp. This was published in 2005, and in there it says, we're not appropriated to do anything here. We don't have the money, but if we're going to try and restore and recover these species, which are dubiously endangered to begin with, these are the areas we think there'd be good critical habitat resources to do that in. Well, if you look at the Army Corps of Engineers cease and desist notices in this area, they're falling right around these mapped vernal pool recovery plan areas. If WOTUS goes through, 95%, I don't know, we've done some states, I know Farm Bureau's mapped a couple of them, it's always more than 90% of the state's surface area is a wetland under the new WOTUS rule. If farmers have to go to the Army Corps of Engineers and get a permit to operate in a wetland under the new WOTUS rules, and that area has been described as a critical habitat area under the Endangered Species Act, the Army Corps of Engineers cannot issue that permit and impact a species habitat if it's endangered or threatened. So if the Fish and Wildlife Service can go up and down our state and for any one species say here's 100,000 acres we think would be nice recovery area or 200,000 areas we think would be nice recovery area, and they can do this for multiple species, they can do it for coho salmon, they can do it for steelhead salmon, they can do it for deer and antelope and frogs and red-legged ones and yellow-legged ones, and they can do it for tiger salamanders. It goes on and on. They can do it for sand fleas and swamp grass. If they can simply map an endangered species to cover the majority of farmland in the state, which by current standards I think they can, and they can map the entire area to be a potential wetland, a water of the United States, farmers can't farm. These regulations together threaten food security in America. So it's a lot of inside baseball. I'm very, very thankful that all of you are here today to understand on a specific farm with a specific farm family how this plays out. But the reason we're here today is not because John DeWardy's having a bad time with the feds. We're here because this is, and the reason it's become a priority for Farm Bureau is because this is a very serious threat to farming as we know it in America. So here we are. This is the government dream team. You know, in the next page, you see a kind of a football huddle of regulators and bureaucrats and excavator drivers out in the looks downstream from a fairly attractive ecological system to me, but they are investigating the problem on a nice pleasant day. That's about 12 inspectors they had out to my property, 450 acres of wheat. plowed 8 inches deep on ground that had been plowed much deeper before. We've got 12 government experts spending several weeks. The next page here is an excavator, and this is just me having fun. This is the government investigating my property. They dug about 20 or 30 backhoe pits in the middle of the wetlands to show that we only plowed 8 inches deep. Now, when you dig 2 or 3 feet deep, you have a real chance at breaking the hardpan and the impervious layers. Not a problem if you're a government investigator. And this is their best practice for restored wetlands. When they came to me and they wanted us to restore the wetlands, they wanted a whole plan of exactly how we're going to restore the wetlands, which to me are already still there. They wanted endowment of millions of dollars to prove that those wetlands would be held restored in perpetuity. They wanted me to go off site and buy restoration credits from the mitigation banks at $2 million. Again, we're talking 450 acres of wheat here. Here, they punch holes right in the middle of the wetland and cover them up with a plow and walk away. There's been no follow-up with us on cooperation to take their damage they did to these wetlands and bring it back to anything close to what their standards are requiring of me and my family. In one of the books, one of the expert reports, there's a expert named last name House who talked about what rotation of crops is and isn't, and what is a normal ongoing farming practice and what isn't. His main reference, references were two sources, this one from 1913, the other one contemporary to it, about what rotational crops meant in an agricultural sense. I literally have San Francisco attorneys reading Farm Knowledge from Sears and Roebuck in 1913 to defend against the expert claims of what crop rotation is or isn't in Tehama County wheat growing in 2012. This is my favorite slide. The next one, you'll see the garden gnome shot in the middle of my field. This is one of the experts. It says, "Do not disturb, federal gnome meditation study underway." You see his little shovel down there next to him. These guys literally did a pebble distribution survey, taking a look at the plowing furrow and where are the pebbles up, down, and crosswise in the plowing furrow to prove that I disturbed the soil when I plowed it and I redistributed pebbles, I guess. But we literally have, on your tax dollar, not dredging Missouri rivers. We're not keeping the yellow gunk out of the Colorado River. We're not keeping the river dredge out of the Great Lakes. No, we're doing pebble surveys on John Zowardy's wheat field. These guys are great. The serious work we did was to show on the next page, if you look at a 1994 survey delineation of wetlands that was done on this property, it mapped out in the gold outline of a couple wetlands. We've got pages and pages of this, trust me. But these are two that are indicative of what we found. If you look at the blue line, that's the 2012 delineation that we got when we bought the property. And if you look at the red line, that's the vernal pool covered area in those two specific vernal pools there when we were done planting wheat 2-3 years ago and what it looks like now. So as you can see, in 2015, the vernal pool is still there. It was there after they planted wheat in 1980. It's here after we planted wheat in 2012. There has been no damage to wetlands on this property. Here it is again. This is the first shot you saw of the vernal pool in the middle of the field. Here's a close-up of it. Now,
John,
yes, sir. Yeah, thank you, Don. And the Corps will say a couple things on most issues. In their own guidance letters, they will tell themselves, we don't respect or look at any delineation that was done more than 5 years ago. Well, none of these delineations are recorded in the property. None of them show up in the title search. The habitat conservation areas don't show up in your title search or as easements on the property. There's no way to know most of this stuff. But the fact is, the 94 wetland delineation, then 2012 wetland delineation, 2015 wetland delineation, they're not different in any material way. The wetlands that were there in 94 are there in 2015. If you look at one of the vernal pools that was, it was plowed through, which again is completely legal under the Clean Water Act, the argument now is, can you almost see a plow furrow still rippling across that? It's maybe hard on your photocopies, but trust me, the plow shanks were about 18 inches apart, and there's a little furrow between them. Well, the argument is the bottoms of those furrows, if you go to the next page, you'll see a couple tape measures making a cross. Maybe it's crucifix. Bottom of those furrows is about 5 inches deeper than the top of those furrows. The U.S. experts are now claiming the bottom of that furrow is still a wetland, but the top of that furrow is now a converted upland. So you go back to the page and look at the vernal pool there. That looks like a wetland in its entirety, but no. The bottom of the furrows in that vernal pool are still wetlands. The top of those that furrow is a converted upland. Now, this seems funny. It seems like minutia. Maybe we could say, wow, Duarte pissed off the feds when the Pacific Legal Foundation stepped in and filed a due process suit against him, because they really can't just drive by a farmer's property and throw a cease and desist notice out the window. They've got to have a hearing. They've got to have some process. They've got to have some kind of jurisdiction. Maybe that's the case. Maybe they're vindictive. Maybe it's just a clown car story. Maybe there's a government clown car. We're making fun of the gnome out there counting pebbles. We're making fun of the 12 investigators. We're making fun of their claims. Maybe it's just a goofy clown car story. And that's, you know, specific to the Duartes, and maybe they won't be that dumb in the future. They thought we were ripping 3 feet deep. It turns out we're ripping 8 inches deep. Army Corps of Engineers has one guy in 5 counties. In each of those counties, there's a cooperative extension, there's an ag commissioner, there's a farm service agency, and there's an NRCS office. But the Army Corps of Engineers wants prime jurisdiction over regulating all this farming operation in 5 counties with one investigator who doesn't know what he's doing. But I don't think it's a clown car story, and I don't think it's a vindictiveness story. This is what we're seeing in many areas of California happen to many farms. This is what's coming to a farm near you under the WOTUS with the Endangered Species Act as it's currently drawn up. More good fun that we're having is if you take crop insurance these days, you have to sign that you won't negatively impact any waters of the United States in your farming operation. Well, negatively impacting waters of the United States has a new definition, and waters of the United States itself has a new definition. So if you want crop insurance, be very careful, because many farming operations are subjecting themselves to false statement claims if they don't realize what the enforcement practices on wetlands currently is. I have a feeling when Dodd-Frank comes through and reviews ag lending practices, the bank regulatory scheme, it's going to require farmers to have crop insurance as a risk mitigation tool. Then try and navigate that one without subjecting yourself to exposure from federal claims. So where is this now? We've spent over, Duarte, my family has spent over $900,000 in legal team and experts. The Pacific Legal Foundation is handling the due process claim. That's through their resources, and they've done a great job on that. And they're going to bat for all of us in that pursuit to make sure that there's adequate due process when farmers are called to stop cultivating their land. They're also handling a retaliatory lawsuit claim. We've got a lot of evidence that the only reason I've got this particular case at this particular time is because they're retaliating against my family for backing the Pacific Legal Foundation the due process claim. But we also know a number of families up in that area are either paying heavy fines or abandoning their plans to farm their ground because of cease and desist letters delivered by the Army Corps of Engineers. There was a whole panel session at the California Farm Bureau meeting this year with several people that my attorney, David Ivester, Brad Gehring, and Tony Francois from the Pacific Legal Foundation. Brad Gehring has been a very good friend of mine, very active in the wetlands issues for some years. And Jody Galloway, who's a consultant up in this area who did some work for us and other farmers on these issues. So we've got $900,000 into this. We go to trial in March. The United States government, even regardless of the budget rider and the reconciliation rider that says they can't spend money on this type of enforcement, has found a rat hole, and they're spending it. They're over $1 million now, and we believe they'll go well over several million dollars enforcing claims against a 450-acre wheat field. We're waiting for rulings on the summary judgments. We hope a few of these things get set aside. And we think if at this point laws and regulations and words in legislation don't have meaning, we then have to ask ourselves, how can we compromise? If we all want to see resolutions to environmental challenges and problems that come up. We want to see we're not against the Clean Water Act as it was first intended. We're not against the Clean Air Act as it was first intended. We're not against the Endangered Species Act as it should have been first written. But if you can't make these compromises in Congress, how do we solve for future problems? If this is what the Clean Water Act means today in the agencies, and this is what happens under it, how can we encourage our legislators to sit down and make any further compromises that might regulate us when after 40 years of that law being in place, Don referenced, where are we going to be 20 years from now? Well, here's where we are 40 years from when these laws were passed. We can't solve problems in the future if we can't have words with meaning that endure in the legislation. So I think it's very, very ominous. I think it's a very important battle. And I think it's important that folks like you take the time, and again, I'm very thankful for that, to understand the inside baseball aspect of this, because we're getting entangled in agriculture. And that noose is tightening around our neck. Seemingly every year it gets a little tighter. And as we start to commingle these different regulatory schemes, we can see how maybe it's the younger folks here at the meeting are going to be most concerned about this. Where are we going to be 20 years from now? So I'll be around today for questions. Very happy to engage it. Thank you, Don. Oh, sure. Be happy to take questions. Yes, sir.
Chris Clayton. Sorry about that. Chris Clayton with DTN. Could you just briefly walk through the litigation? I mean, they issued a cease and desist against you, and then you filed a claim against the agency. All of the litigation involved here?
Let's do that. The Corps filed a cease and desist notice against us in February of 2013. At that time, I worked with a local attorney, Rhonda Lucas, who sent a letter back and said, "You're claiming my client operated in wetlands, deep ripped, did all these things. What's your evidence? Show us why you think that." They sent a letter back to us and said, "You've been kicked up to enforcement now. Communicate with them. Don't communicate with the field agent that has any of the facts. And by the way, you give us all your information." And they ignored her Freedom of Information Act request and gave us nothing. So at that point, she took the second letter to the Pacific Legal Foundation, Sacramento, where she had some contacts, and they said, "Yeah, well, this is a due process issue. They can't send you a cease and desist." And then when you ask them for a hearing and information, they can't get more onerous on you without responding to your Freedom of Information Act request. And so at that point, the Pacific Legal Foundation decided this would be an excellent due process case to take forward. The facts here are very clear, and it looks like a good one. And Mark Miller is here from the Pacific Legal Foundation. He can go deeper on that. So we filed the due process case with the Pacific Legal Foundation with some warning that there'd likely be a destruction of wetlands countersuit, or at least the very real possibility of a retaliatory suit coming. The agent who first made the observations and got the ball rolling has never been deposed before. Nobody ever sues the Army Corps of Engineers because of this. And so they get away with what they do. And so they filed a retaliatory lawsuit against us in, I think, 2014. And so we've been preparing that for trial with discovery and going through there. They also named me individually. They, of course, Doherty Nursery owned the land, which is a corporation owned by my family. But they came after me individually, which is a bit of a spurious strategy on their part. But they, you know, unless I'm driving the plow, came after me individually. So we have a motion to have that dismissed. And then we have a motion to determine that this case, that the lawsuit filed for destruction of wetlands is a retaliatory lawsuit. We actually have on deposition the tractor driver, a gentleman from up north there who just plants wheat and does that kind of contracting generally, getting calls from the Department of Justice attorneys about us. And he asked them, "Hey, you know, why are you going after the Duartys anyways?" And the Department of Justice attorney is quoted, without them denying it, telling the tractor driver, "Well, they're suing us, so I guess we're suing them." and so that and some other circumstantial stuff in the timelines of the case make it fairly clear this is a retaliatory lawsuit. And again, the Department of Justice and Army Corps had attempted to have that dismissed several times and has not been able to accomplish that. The judge is letting it go forward on that claim. So those are the four motions for summary judgment that are still in play. The due process claim from the Pacific Legal Foundation, the retaliatory suit claim from us, the destruction of wetland claim against the nursery, and the destruction of wetlands claim against me personally. Yes, sir.
Most of our farmers and ranchers are aware of the general issue of the waters of the United States rule. They're also aware of dramatic federal agency action against individual landholders. But in this particular case, what concrete advice would you offer to a farmer or a rancher who sees this issue from a distance and all of a sudden is faced with a love note or perhaps a visit from a federal agent? What should he or she do at that moment based upon your experience?
Well, I really can't give that advice because it comes down to some personal decisions. I would be financially better off if I'd have just thrown up my hands, said, fine, not here, not now. And so individually, I think the reason that this has gotten as big as it has is because most growers are just giving up use of their farmland and letting the federal regulators come in and set their priorities for habitat over the top of individual property owners' goals for their land and their farming operations. So they have to make a personal choice. Do they want to duck for cover and let the bureaucrats do what they want to do? Or do they want to stand and fight and bring it to the mat? And that's why we have Farm Bureau. That's why we have the Pacific Legal Foundation, because individually, a lot of these issues become insurmountable. But hopefully, if we can get the right court outcomes and take a few of these issues to the mat and win in Congress, which we thought we already did, but you know, we thought we had a livable compromise in the legislation to begin with, but these agencies and this administration don't want to live within the bounds of those compromises. Then we have to stand up and fight. Yes, sir.
District that you're actually dealing with, the Army Corps district that you're dealing with, is this just that they're a very activist group? I mean, they're going after other landowners besides yourself?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're not that special. They've gotten huge settlements out of some families. They get land set aside. They get growers that simply give up on the higher value uses of their land, so it becomes much more feasible for them to take fines or penalties or endowments, pull that of guys like me, and use it to buy other land to put into habitat. This is the government having priorities for habitat conservation that the government can't get appropriated through its own budget process, so it finds individual landowners to put pressure on and drain them to accomplish some of these habitat owners. This isn't far different from what I understand about the Hammond case up in Oregon. Set aside the activist part of that, but just the Hammond family themselves. The government wants their land, and they're going to put whatever onerous pressures they can on that family to get that land for their priorities.